Hey there, web or podcast listeners. I'm Vermont Edition producer Matthew Smith, and I wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited to make it a little bit shorter and a little bit sweeter. Thanks, and I hope you enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The first case is a red herring. I know, spoiler alert, but you'd figure that out pretty quickly. Well, it's not exactly a red herring. But it gives you a sense of who you're dealing with. Sally Kravitz, a PI with a stronger sense of moral obligation than most, perhaps. I'm talking about the first scene in Bomber's Moon, the new Joe Gunther detective novel from Newfane author Archer Mayer. It's the 30th Joe Gunther story, actually. Quite a feat. The Joe Gunther novels are on bedstands around the world, with hungry readers devouring a new one each year. Joe Gunther even has his own Wikipedia page. And Archer Mayer has been celebrated with awards, reviews, profiles, and plaudits. And so we thought we'd mark the occasion of this 30th book by not only talking with Archer Mayer himself, but by inviting more than 100 of our friends as well. We are in VPR Stetson Studio 1 today in front of a live audience. Audience, would you like to make yourselves known? We are joined by Archer Mayer to talk about this book, his alter ego, Joe Gunther, and how Mayer's and Gunther's lives cross and diverge. Archer, it is a pleasure to talk with you again. Thank you for being here.
Well, it's almost overwhelming to be here, so thank you very much.
One thing the Wikipedia page on Joe Gunther reveals is that as the series opens, now 30 years ago, Gunther is a 30-year veteran of the police force and a Korean War vet.
What's your point?
Well, given that we're now three decades on, he is remarkably strong and vibrant for, what, a 90-year-old
man?
Well,
that's how you take on your decades versus how he takes on his, which is just a walk in the park, clearly.
So how do you stay excited explaining who Gunther is 30 times on in a way that introduces him to new readers but doesn't bore the readers who have known your stories for 30 years now?
I think the first obligation is not to become bored yourself. I have one of these sort of radars in my head that anticipates a writer's engagement in his or her own work. That meter, I think, is shared by all readers. And when we flip through the pages, because all writers are readers to begin with, and when we flip through the pages, we can sort of smell at a mile off if the writer is fully engaged or not. I write these books. I don't want to sound, you know, overly poetical, but sort of because I'm on earth to do so. It's a huge responsibility. Now, having said that, I know there are murder mysteries. Okay, don't get me wrong. I'm not competing with dead Faulkner, but I do take my job very seriously. I try not to screw up. I try to honor my readers with whom I write these books. This is a collaborative art. It's done in isolation, but it's not done for them, but it is done as a storytelling process, and that only works if you get feedback, if you get a response from all these guys, and a few more, I hope. So that communication keeps you sharp, or damn well should. And so I'll edit each one of these books using other editors or myself. It's a process, but that process will force me to go over these books sometimes up to 20 times a book. So that's a 300-page book times 20 times. So I try to cut out everything that shouldn't be there. I try to put in everything that should go in. This is serious work. And then you have to make it look like fun, which of course it is.
Do you have readers who are either, you know, 30-year veterans of the Joe Gunther series and others who have never read a Joe Gunther book and see if they both like it?
Well, of course, this is the challenge. And so that's why I can laugh at the math majors that go, for God's sake, the man's 92 years old. That's the least of my concerns. You know? much more important is the fact that someone who has stuck with me since 1988 will go, oh, I really like the latest one. You're keeping it fresh and new, and I learn new stuff. Versus the newcomer who says, I hope, never, who the hell are these people? You don't explain who they are. So I've got to constantly reward the faithful and not pull a rabbit out of the hat with the newcomers.
Archer, you just said, while trying not to sound too poetic, that you were put on this earth to write these books.
Yes.
Now, some authors will say, I'm driven to write. I'm just driven to create and to write stories. But it sounds to me like you feel like you were not only driven to write, but to write about Joe Gunther. I mean, you can't do this for 30 years without feeling a kind of, you know, some kind of connection to the person who is your hero.
Right. And it's not that Joe Gunther is a police officer. The point to Joe Gunther, and this hits me deeply and personally, is that I write not about, you know, someone who has a drinking problem or came from an unhappy childhood or who, as tropes seem to insist, has a burden on his shoulders. That seems very common nowadays. You watch TV, you go to the movies, you read other books, then you'll find a man in this context, heavily weighted by the onus of living. Joe has had his lumps, perhaps. I won't take that away from him. In fact, at one point, I even wrote a specifically. I wrote one of the books where he didn't get hit once. I've never done that again, but I did it. I did it that time. But my mission from the start. And this was driven by my life before I began writing Joe Gunther, is to write about a decent human being. This man is kind, thoughtful, avuncular, a team player, possibly therefore the most boring person on earth.
Except
that he is the keel of this ship of endless books and some fairly squirrely colleagues.
I think that's fair, although, you know, as they've evolved, all of the colleagues he's currently working with in Bomber's Moon are pretty good people.
Yeah. And they have worked through their adversity if such has been their fate. Other times they just are sort of regular folks who, for some reason or another, ended up happily working with Joe. But Joe is the centerpiece. Joe is sort of the go-to guy, which is why he's not always necessarily right in the thick of things. Because after a while, Joe becomes a kind of weighted presence that every other person with whom he interacts knows they can go to him for consistent thoughtfulness and, as to use that word again, decency. And decency, especially in these modern times, is a premium. The decency in my own life has been something for which I have yearned and looked at various times for various reasons. And it's something that I think needs heralding more often than not. Yes, we can pretend to be Arnold Schwarzenegger and lift tall buildings with a single hand. Boy, there's a mangled metaphor. what happened to just old-fashioned showing up and doing the job and being consistently heartfelt? And there's Joe. Joe is not going to light up any party, but one hopes that when times get tough, you'll go to Joe.
Without feeling like I'm trying to be your psychologist.
Well, let me make myself comfortable
here.
Please
do. You just mentioned that at times you have felt like that human decency was lacking in your own life.
Yes.
Is Joe Gunther... I mean, despite your similar ages in the stories, is Joe Gunther a father figure, a friend? I mean, how do you sort of see him when you step out of the fact that you're the creator and he is on paper?
No, he's not a father figure. My father was a wonderful guy, so I'm not trying to...
to find a new father?
Yeah, right, exactly. We won't go that far into the shrink factory. But Joe Gunther is a kind of an ideal. He is what we would like to see in our father figures, be they political leaders, be they bosses, be they the people we're married to. He is the antidote to those times in our lives, and we've all had these moments where we are disappointed by the behavior of a fellow human being who, with just as much effort to do the right thing versus the wrong thing, they did the wrong thing, and you think to yourself, good God, we didn't ask for extra exertion for you to simply go towards the proper direction. And Joe Gunther is a kind of poster boy for that.
We have a note from Kenny who wrote in to say, I have read all of your books as well as most of Louise Penny's series out of Quebec. As an ex-Quebecer living in Vermont for almost 30 years, I enjoy the familiarity of the setting of both series. Any chance you and Ms. Penny would consider collaborating on a book incorporating your Joe Gunther and her Inspector Gamache?
Well, I don't know. I'm embarrassed to admit that the very first time I met Ms. Penny, she threw her arms around me and kissed me. So already our relationship is compromised. That was right in front of my wife. Truth be known, she also then threw her arms around my wife's neck and kissed her. So all's well that ends well. No, I wouldn't collaborate with anyone. And the reason for that is that this is intensely personal stuff. I think, in fact, my wife will tell you that I sort of go into private mode when I write these books. I do more than just go into my office and write books. I also exclude almost everybody else from sharing what's going on. And it's not because it's grandma's secret recipe. It's because of the ever-changing format that this book is eventually going to take. I don't write outlines. I don't have notes. I don't have a plot. I do a lot of research. I do a lot of free-form thinking as I'm wandering around. And as you know, I wear other hats. So I'm responding to emergency calls. I'm doing whatever I need to do to help my fellow human being through their mishigash. But I'm also always thinking of the plot and how I want these real-life situations to influence my fictional world. To have someone else, even as skilled as Louise, speaking from the outside would be very disorienting. It would be like running an air traffic control center and someone else saying, oh, my God, there's a plane out the window. You go, you know, I got it on radar. Just let me deal, okay?
If you go into sort of private mode every time you write a book and you're writing one book a year, it sounds like maybe we caught you on your one day a year where you come out.
Yeah, I was going to tell you that book just got ruined.
Sorry.
But don't worry about it. You know, I'm supposed to be able to make stuff up, so I'll cope.
Louise Penny did once tell me that she didn't want to be like Agatha Christie, who purportedly grew to loathe Poirot.
Oh.
And I don't blame her, frankly. But Louise Penny always modeled Inspector Gamache actually after her husband, because she said, I want to love this person if I'm going to have to live with him for so many years. And it sounds like you feel the same way about Joe Gunther.
In a way, except that I've never three-dimensionalized Joe Gunther. He doesn't have a face to me. Very early on, I eschewed all descriptors. So we know that, for example, Willie Kunkel, another character, has a bum arm, but we don't know if he's tall or short or skinny or fat or whatnot. The same holds true for Joe. Joe is a spirit. And I hope, therefore, he's a spirit that everyone can share. I like to see Joe as everyone's either favorite or wannabe father, brother, husband.
You know, he's a stand-in.
Friend.
In some ways.
Yeah, he should be malleable and available to one and all. And I don't want to, nor am I stimulated by superimposing him on any real person I ever knew.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and today we are live in Stetson Studio One here at VPR's headquarters. We're accommodating more than 100 people who are here to see today's show with renowned author Archer Mayer. His latest novel, Bomber's Moon, the 30th in his Joe Gunther detective series, just came out. And we have members of our audience here who have submitted questions before the show started. And let's go to one of those first. Let's go to Stu, who normally is in Bethel, but Stu today is actually here in the VPR studios in Colchester. Stu, come on up. We'd love to know your question.
Didn't expect this at all. This has been absolutely delightful to listen to you talk. I was going to say Joe, because the reading about Joe Gunther is just wonderful. My question is, what's the role of your editor? And so I'll leave it at that.
I might well ask the same question, but no. And the funny thing is that if you're referring to my New York City editor, the one that appears in all the movies that you see about other writers, you know, where they come to office with a hat that they never take off and that kind of stuff, he answers cheerily to occasional emails, but he, in fact, does so little editing that oftentimes he doesn't even acknowledge that he received my manuscript when I send it to him. And the reason for that reflects less on his abilities as an editor. Actually, I've heard parenthetically that they've said, oh, your editor's Keith? Good God, you know, what a savage. And I go, really? The point being is that the manuscripts I give to him are so well edited, he's actually, out of professional courtesy, he just hands them down to production, the manuscripts. He doesn't really edit them much at all. He might make a vague comment now and then about this, that, or the other, but they're so peaceful and so muted that they really... I sometimes have to get back to him and say, you know, are you really jumping up and down about this? And he went, no. Just an idea. So he's very hands-off. Now, the reason for that is that I probably employ, from my wife Margot on up, 5 to 6 to sometimes 8 different editors of my own choosing. And he knows nothing about them. Okay, so I go around for months going back and forth and back and forth, and we head jam like crazy because in order to qualify as one of my personal editors, you've got to eat raw meat every morning. I mean, there's none of this, oh, that's a nice book, dear. It's got to be, you know, paragraph 1, page 1. Well, what did you mean by this? Because it's my responsibility to accept this information or not and to act on it or not. But if there's no feedback, then it's useless. So I need more rather than less. And by the time I send that resulting manuscript to my editor, they're pretty goddamn well edited. And he knows it. So he's a happy camper, and so am I, because I've had so many more conversations with so many talented people that his talents really don't need to be applied much longer. So that's how it works.
I want to take another question here, and this one is from Peter, who's calling in from Austin, Texas. Hi, Peter. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. I went to high school with Archer, and
it's that Peter.
It's that Peter. Yeah.
You dirty dog.
Gotcha. And he, you know, most likely would have been voted least likely to become a police officer, death investigator, volunteer EMS, volunteer firefighter, possibly most likely to be to be an author, and I just want to know, you know, what the heck happened? What pushed you towards those vocations?
Peter, thank you for your call. You had another thing you wanted to say too, Peter?
Well, no, that's my question. Thank you.
Archer, we didn't tell you this is your life today. So
people
from various stages.
Or queen for a day, you know, if you have a certain age.
That's right.
Isn't that interesting? Yes, this has been an interesting life, and I think the books have benefited accordingly. A lot of people, I think, look in the mirror and they go, oh, God, what am I going to do today? I don't. My life has been an eventful and unusual one, largely formatted by things beyond my control that occurred to me at an early age and which changed the direction of my life considerably. As a result of that childhood event, I had to sort of, grow up self-taught, self-learning, and to make some fundamental decisions as to how I turned out. I could go down a very dark hole, or I could try to become a societal asset of sorts. Now, on top of that unfortunate event that occurred to me at an early age was also just the circumstance that I come from a family moved around so much. Actually, some of you in this audience may have heard me say this before, that my father moved so often we thought he had a criminal record. But whether he did or not was never actually brought to light. But following behind a guy like that and having this thing that occurred to me meant that you were pretty isolated and therefore also not a part of any society or any culture or any language, in fact, because I was brought up all over the world or half the world. And the end result of that is that you become extraordinarily isolated unto yourself.
Can I stop you? You've mentioned an event several times, but I don't know what it is.
I had an unfortunate continuum of encounters as a child that lasted approximately 9 months. And you can fill in whatever blanks you wish.
Trauma?
Yes, that would be fair to say. And that changes a person dramatically. And actually, as a police investigator, I worked with, in fact, my specialty was sex crimes against kids. And it was an interesting returning to the fold. I've never told anyone this. So don't say anything, for God's sake.
You make light, but it sounds like it was awfully painful.
Well, it was informative. There's nothing I could do about it. So then what do you do about it? And you can go in a variety of directions. And some of those are not of your choosing. Some of those are things from which you retreat hastily because you realize you've made the bad choice. But all of it is informative because it makes you, or in my case, it made me, extraordinarily sensitive to my fellow human beings and what they may be up to and what they may be thinking versus what they may be doing and vice versa. It makes life for an 11-year-old far more complicated, and I had nowhere to go, so I had to sort of internalize this and then problem solve. Now, I come from a sort of a straightforward, pragmatic, problem-solving New England background. So you don't get mad, you don't get even, you just fix it. So I began fixing it. And one of the things I paid attention to was that wonderful old sort of treacly trope from the 1960s, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. And I'll be damned if I didn't take that to heart. So I began to pay attention to the fact that I was a rootless person without a country without a culture and without a language. In fact, English for a while was my second language. French was my first. And when I came back from Europe with a very thick accent and poor control over the English language, which is why I lapse every once in a while, so forgive me that, I began to look at the artifacts of civilization, which are bright flashing lights and howling sirens and trucks going back and forth filled with people in uniform doing something. And I thought to myself, well, maybe they're the applicators of solutions. Maybe they're actually trying to help people out. And in answer to Peter's question, I came to the realization after I moved to Vermont in 1980 because I needed to come home. Now, I've never lived in Vermont. I don't have any ties to Vermont. But Vermont is my home. It's the only home I've ever had. And they made me welcome. Northern hospitality exists.
Even if it's a little bit cold and removed.
So all of you took me in, and I thought the least I could do is to try to help you out to the best of my abilities. I will do so in the writing of my books by talking about us, you know, Vermonters and regular human beings in times of stress and upset. I will also go beyond that. And if in my various careers, if your house is on fire, if you fell down and hurt yourself, if a member of your family died, if you've been criminalized in some way or another, you know, in various ways, shapes, or forms, including at the present moment where I still work for the medical examiner's office, I'll show up and I will try to put my hands on the problem.
I want to ask you about that, and this is going to get us down to the lowest common denominator. Now, I'm going to protect the names of the innocent, although she may have already mentioned this to you, but a mutual friend of ours who lives in your town once told me she was horrified to think someday she knew she's going to fall in the bathtub and Archer Mayer is going to show up as an EMT in town, yeah, or hopefully not as the death investigator, but yeah, as an EMT and help her out, and that she would either end up in, you know, the town gossip circles or in one of your books having fallen in the tub in her altogether. Yeah. So do you find that people now run from you in town?
That, I don't know. Wow. We need to talk.
Sir. Yes, we do. Off the record, I'm sure. Yeah.
I'm not that terrifying, but it is true that in certain of my occupations, I will take your last photographs.
Yes.
No, the funny thing is that if you become one of my, how should I put this? If you become one of my customers, that's probably the best guarantee that you will never recognize yourself in a novel. Because my professional ethic is absolute and ironclad that I will never bring a real case or real of human beings into these books. Now, I'm also not an idiot. So I'm standing in these cesspool of raw human emotion on a daily basis in any number of occupations, given this strange life that I've pursued that baffles Peter so deeply.
Yes, you work for the medical examiner. You're a death investigator. You've been a police officer. You've been a sheriff. You've been an EMT and a volunteer firefighter, and so on and so on.
So on and so forth. Exactly right. There are times where for 9 nights in a row I haven't been at home because I've been at some squad meeting or another. And I've been conducting trainings at squad meetings where my pager goes off to a response to my own house because of a dryer fire. And I'm like, all right, what hat do I wear here? You know, turns out there was no dryer fire, but that was...
That's another story.
It was a little startling. But the point being that if I am occupying an environment, a real one, and I see some really neat stuff... I will change so much of it that co-investigators won't recognize what I bring into a book, but I will bring it into a book.
Let's see if we can get another question in here from our audience before we take another break. Alcest from Shelburne has a question. Alcest, we'd love to have you come on up.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting us. This is great fun. My question is, anybody who reads the Sunday New York Times will recognize this question, so I can't take 100% credit for it. But it is, if you were giving a dinner party, what three authors, dead or alive, would you invite and why?
None. They all do what I do. No, actually, in a funny kind of way, I mean, it's always nice to sit down with a glitterati, but I wouldn't get a word in edgewise. I once had Galbraith to dinner, the old man, and... I might as well just wash the dishes. You just can't get a word in edgewise. So, I mean, I guess it's okay to be a fly in the world on the wall, but it wasn't a very constructive evening. So they do kind of what I do. The people I want at my dining room table are the people I don't know and who do things I'm not familiar with. I have two outboard motors that fuel me from book to book to book, aside from all the emotional stuff and all that, and that is ignorance and curiosity. I look in the mirror every morning, even at my advanced old age, and I see the most ignorant person I know, and therefore I got to go out and ask someone who does what I don't do and who knows a lot more about stuff than I do, what do you do? Why do you do it? How do you do it? That's what ends up in these books. These books, I have been approached by editors and said, that last book you wrote, that was a pip. That was perfect. Do it again. And let's make some money. Maybe this is rationalizing never having made much money, but my response is no. I want to run the risk of stumbling rather than repeating myself. There's no joy in that. And we go back to Jane's comment earlier about, writing books that sound familiar. Those books sound familiar because they are familiar to the writer because they're safe. You can get away with something. You do that one dance step because you've memorized that dance step. The trick is every time you go on the dance floor, and I can't dance a step, but you go on that dance floor and you try something new every time. So I'm stuck with my own voice. I'm stuck with these characters. I'm stuck with Vermont, blessedly. I'm stuck with lots of things that are just part and parcel of my three-dimensional humanity, but I will always try to do something new in every one of these books and therefore run the risk of stumbling. I'd sooner do that than follow someone's advice about hitting a home run second, third, fourth time out of the park. That's of no interest to me.
This is Vermont Edition, live in Stetson Studio 1 at VPR's headquarters in Colchester. I'm Jane Lindholm, and we have a live audience here with us today as Newfane author Archer Mayer joins us. We're talking about his new novel, Bomber's Moon, except we're not really talking about the new novel much. We're more talking about Archer, his motivation, his background. We got a call from a high school friend. It's an interesting time to be able to talk to an author, especially one who has gone through so many iterations and circled around the same characters for so many years, because within that sameness, there's also so much depth and difference. So I appreciate Archer being here, and I appreciate all of you being here with your questions. And let's take another question from our audience. Tom is with us from Essex. Tom, we'd love to hear what you're wondering about.
Well, thank you for this event, and I'm here because of a good friend named Joe. Not your Joe, but he was supposed to be here with me, but medical things kept him away. He would be a good character in one of your books, which goes to my question. After 30 years of creating various characters, how do you go about discovering a new character?
I keep my eyes open, and I listen a lot, and I don't stay in my office, and I don't hang out with people that society would assume I should hang out with. My wife calls all my friends my peeps, because You know, you look at someone with my background, my education, my way of stumbling around multi-syllable words, all the rest of it, and you think, oh, well, you know, he's not going to hang out at a firehouse. But the fire department is more my family than my family. You know, you get to choose the people you hang out with, and the people I hang out with are not the people that you'd think a Yale-educated la-di-da who speaks two languages and has traveled the world would hang out with, because to mimic what I said about sitting down and having dinner with a bunch of writers is that they know what I know, and I'm not interested in my own experiences. I've lived those, thank you very much. I want to find out what most of this world is constructed of, which are the people who are overlooked and not listened to with a particular acuity, but whose opinions matter. And it's important to me to hang out with people who are not necessarily like-minded, whose politics may be completely averse from mine, because they're going to educate me far more than some pal who agrees with everything I say. That having been said, I have not the slightest notion what your question was. But that's the answer.
How do you come up with new characters? And you're talking about these characters, and you know, most of your books are set in and around Brattleboro. Some go elsewhere. But I'm curious if anyone in Brattleboro, like the Chamber of Commerce, ever comes to you and says, you know, maybe lay off the opioid stuff, but could you mention how Brooks House is really beautiful
for
now?
For God's sake, Jane, they threw a Joe Gunther weekend. So, gluttons for punishment, perhaps. I haven't the slightest idea. But no, I've never met anybody who takes umbrage at Joe, the books, or what I do. I particularly identify one group, because my daughter is a member of this. But librarians are the single most bloody-minded people I've ever encountered. There's no library I go to, and I go to a lot of them, where the librarian doesn't take me aside at one point and said, would you mind killing someone in my library?
Well, there's a very helpful librarian in Bomber's Moon.
Yeah.
Before we go too far and run the risk of not even mentioning it, can you at least explain the title of Bomber's Moon?
Bomber's Moon, yes. Well, Bomber's Moon is, I have a fondness for history. I don't even read murder mysteries. In fact, who would want to do that? So I read history, and I of course was brought up in Europe, and World War II was the capstone of a lot of bloody mindedness there. And Bomber's Moon refers to those times when bombardiers in those kind of aircraft in World War II would cherish the existence of a bomber's moon, which is just a fancy word for a full moon, because they could better see their targets. But of course, the irony is almost inscripted in the same image. What you can see you. So the anti-aircraft gunners, they love bomber's moons, a nice sharp silhouette to aim at. So beware what you wish for is basically the subtext to the title Bomber's Moon. And in case after case, within the context of that novel, there are people who benefit by the clarity of a bomber's moon without understanding the inset irony.
Yeah, and we won't go too deep into the characters, but I will say, as you mentioned, Joe Gunther certainly is a feature in the novel, but by no means the main character or the only character driving the narrative. There are lots of different people swirling around, and readers who have read your previous books will recognize characters coming back here and a sort of a fleshed-out version of some characters who you might want to know more about and what they've been up to in the ensuing years.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's have another question here from Isabel, who's with us from Shelburne. Isabel, hi. We'd love to know what question you have for Archer Mayer.
Since I'm a brand new fan, having just read your first book, first book, I'd like to know, have you considered a climate change villain for your next mystery.
Can't imagine where that comes from.
You have featured a Tropical Storm Irene has been a character.
Oh, yes, yes,
You've
yes.
talked
I
about
always
the closed
refer to
nuclear
that novel
plant.
As the wet book. Yes, in fact, I was investigating a possible criminal complaint right in the middle of Irene, so I was significantly damp during that outing. Instead of staying undercover, I was supposed to go out there and wade. So, in answer to your question, everything is fair game, and I've only written the 30th. And the 31st is in my computer completed, and I'm in editing it right now. So beware what you wish for. We may have some fun yet.
Let's fit one more in here. We're running close to the time, but let's see if we can go to Connie, who's from Burlington and has joined us today. Connie, would you like to ask your question?
Oh, Connie's an old friend. I'm going
to have to out her.
Did you like the cookies?
I love the cookies. Of course I like the cookies. It took me a week to recover.
I want to know if there's anything happening on the possibility of a series with Joe Gunter.
You mean a TV series?
The TV series, yes. Well, we hope. But you know what hope springs from, you know, eternal expectation. So, yes, we are entering a contract, a more slow motion activity I've rarely engaged in. Paint drying is warp speed compared to this activity, but rumor has it that that we are going to be signing a contract. Now, what is the significance of this? Nothing. But hopeful. So it does mean that other people are interested in your inquiry, but they may have more money than you, and that's a good thing. So we'll see what happens. I personally, having one of my 36 previous jobs to being a writer was being a photographer. So I write visually, and I think that Vermont, which is a pretty poorly understood state because it's reduced to caricature, has a lot to offer people who really want to spend attention doing this kind of thing decently, properly, and with acuity. I sort of doubt that any of those three will be applied in the final project, but who cares? At that point, I'll have a new truck, and I'll be a happy man.
Well, and hopefully your audience will still be getting number 31, 32, and 33. So, Archer Mayer, on the heels of the publication of Bomber's Moon, I want to thank you very much for coming in today, talking with us about more than 30 years now of Joe Gunther, but 30 books of Joe Gunther, and this one, the 30th, just being published. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a delight. Thank you, Jane.